18. The Resistance Within. On the sidelines of the NATO meetings on July 11, 2018, Trump believed he had struck a bargain with Recep Tayyip Erdogan. News cameras captured Trump and the Turkish president bumping fists and smiling. What the public did not know at the time was Trump thought he had a deal for a straightforward prisoner trade. The United States would win the freedom and return of Andrew Brunson, an evangelical American pastor imprisoned in Turkey for the previous 2 years on what U.S. officials considered bogus terrorism charges. Brunson was a cause célèbre for Trump's conservative base. Trump would then leverage his close relationship with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to negotiate the release of a Turkish prisoner jailed in Israel on exaggerated claims of terrorist activity. In Trump's mind, he had brokered the deal during a man-to-man meeting with Erdogan. Erdogan had mentioned the Turkish prisoner Ebru Özkan, a 27-year-old woman accused of acting as a smuggler for Hamas. Trump was intrigued. He, too, had a prisoner in Turkey he wanted released. On July 27th, the deal fell apart. Erdogan had tried to flatter Trump by telling him that surely he could get Özkan released. The American president said he could, and then mentioned Brunson. But U.S. officials would later learn that Erdogan never thought this was a tit-for-tat. Trump left the meeting believing he had personally negotiated it. He had not, said one person familiar with the talks. On top of that, something went wrong in the conversation. Somehow, Trump left Erdogan with the impression he could get more for his dollar. The exchange was complicated for many reasons. First and foremost, delegate negotiations about Brunson's release had been going on for weeks between lower-level deputies in both the U.S. and the Turkish governments. Turkish officials originally said Erdogan would be willing to give up Brunson in exchange for the United States deporting or extraditing Fethullah Gulen, a reviled political opponent of Erdogan's who had been living in exile in Pennsylvania. U.S. officials shot down that idea. No way. That would be a decision for the Justice Department, and attorneys there had already made clear that an extradition of that nature would break U.S. legal norms. It was obvious to anyone following the situation that Erdogan's unstated goal almost certainly was to have Gulen killed as soon as he left the United States and landed in another country. So the Americans came up with a three-step approach that the Turks liked. The first step, agreed to in June and conveyed by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, was that the Justice Department and the FBI would more closely investigate whether Gulenist groups in the United States were engaged in illegal activities, such as tax violations. The second step would be helping secure the release of Özkan from Israel. The third step had the feel of a prisoner exchange. After Turkey released Brunson back to the United States, the U.S. government would extradite a Turkish banker and Erdogan ally who was being detained in the United States in a federal case. The banker, who had incriminating information about Erdogan's role in a bribery and money laundering scheme to avoid U.S. sanctions against Iran, would then be allowed to serve the rest of his short sentence in his home country. Trump had little familiarity with the details of those talks. There was no official transcript of his discussion with Erdogan, no direct proof of his apparent deal for U.S. intelligence or diplomatic officials to hold the Turkish government to account. On July 14th, while Trump spent the weekend at his golf resort in Scotland, he decided, in the middle of playing around, to call Netanyahu. His aides brought a secure phone out to the front nine. Trump leaned into the Israeli prime minister and asked him to release Özkan. Netanyahu confessed that he knew nothing about the woman. Her name did not register with him. But he agreed to look into it and to help speed her release, barring some other issue. The next day, July 15th, Uzkan was released. She flew from Israel to Istanbul, where she was met by reporters and professed gratitude for Erdogan, who she said was kind enough to be very interested in my case. Over the next several days, Trump asked his aides for updates on Brunson. The first sign was not encouraging. On July 18th, a Turkish court rejected appeals to release Brunson and set another court date for October. At the White House, where the president had just returned from his European trip, officials were taken aback. Trump tweeted that the Turkish court's decision was a total disgrace. On July 25th, the court convened again and ordered that Brunson be released. Top advisors to Trump, as well as outside Christian advocates who had long been pushing for the pastor's release, prepared that Wednesday night to celebrate Brunson's homecoming. But what happened next surprised Americans familiar with the negotiations. Brunson was released from prison, but on the morning of July 26th, was taken by national police to his Turkish home and placed under house arrest. Through back channels, the United States learned Brunson would be detained in Turkey. Pompeo wrote on Twitter that the court's decision was welcome, but it is not enough. We have seen no credible evidence against Mr. Brunson and call on Turkish authorities to resolve his case immediately in a transparent and fair manner. On July 26th, Trump called Erdogan and was livid. The call was short, with Trump doing most of the talking and not getting the answers he wanted. Trump then took to Twitter to announce his displeasure. "The United States will impose large sanctions on Turkey," he wrote. "This innocent man of faith should be released immediately." Hours later, a senior Turkish official issued a statement calling reports of Trump's making a deal with Erdogan at NATO for a prisoner exchange between the United States and Turkey completely baseless. According to the Turks, whatever deal Trump believed he had miraculously sealed with Erdogan was one of his own imagination. Trump took this as a personal affront. He had long admired Erdogan, attracted to him because of his ruthless rule in Turkey and the ease with which he dispatched political rivals. Ever preoccupied with optics, Trump told advisors he admired the deep and commanding sound of Erdogan's voice. "It's unfucking believable," one of Trump's senior advisors recalled. "I can't describe it. When he's on that speakerphone, it is like you're hearing Hitler at a Nuremberg rally. You've heard Hitler's voice, and it's just different. There is something about it that's powerful and chilling. You feel like you're maybe hearing Satan talking or whatever. When Erdogan talks, it's so powerful, it's disturbing. It's just like this booming voice and said in a cadence." On August 16th, during a cabinet meeting, Trump brought up the terrible Turks. "Turkey, they have not proven to be a good friend," he said. "They have a great Christian pastor there. He's a very innocent man." That is when Trump publicly acknowledged for the first time his role in the Israeli prisoner trade. "We got somebody out for him," he said, referring to Erdogan. "He needed help getting somebody out of someplace. They came out." "They want to hold our wonderful pastor," Trump added. "Not fair. Not right." Brunson would stay in Turkey for another 2 months until he was finally released when a judge lifted the travel ban on the pastor, giving him a window to quickly grab his belongings, race to the airport, and flee the country. Facing unrelenting economic pressure and the added threat of U.S. sanctions, Erdogan gave up the fight with Trump. On October 13th, Brunson's first stop upon returning to the United States was the White House, where he rested his hand on Trump's shoulder, knelt in prayer, and thanked the president. Trump claimed a diplomatic coup for his administration. It took longer and was messier than the president anticipated, but the pastor was nevertheless free. On August 15th, Trump seized an opportunity to retaliate against the national security professionals who had publicly condemned his handling of Russia's election interference or questioned his fitness to be president. Chief among them was John Brennan, the former CIA director who had delivered an intelligence briefing to Trump about the Russian operation back in January 2017, and had since become an outspoken critic of the president, both on social media and in his role as an NBC News analyst. Sarah Sanders made a striking announcement at her August 15th press briefing. Brennan's security clearance was being revoked. Reading a statement she attributed to Trump, Sanders said Brennan posed a risk to national security by his erratic conduct and behavior. She accused the former CIA director of making a series of unfounded and outrageous allegations, wild outbursts on the internet and television about this administration. Ironically, these were the same charges many, if not most, national security professionals would level against Trump. Brennan, 62, had devoted 25 years of his career to the CIA. He worked as a Near East and South Asia analyst, a CIA station chief in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and a director of the National Counterterrorism Center. He served under President Clinton, President George W. Bush, and then in the Obama administration, where he was Homeland Security Advisor and later CIA Director. Trump was also considering revoking the security clearances of other national security officials, each of whom the president considered a personal enemy. Former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, former FBI Director James Comey, former Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe, former Acting Attorney General Sally Yates, former CIA Director Michael Hayden, and former National Security Advisor Susan Rice, as well as two recently departed FBI officials, Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, and one current Justice Department official, Bruce Orr. To many professionals in the national security community, this extraordinary action crossed a red line. Among those shocked was William McRaven, who had earned the title Bullfrog among special operators for being one of the longest serving in that elite corps. The former Navy admiral had been a commander of the U.S. Joint Special Operations Command and led the 2011 raid on a Pakistani compound that killed Osama bin Laden, the al-Qaeda terrorist mastermind of 9/11. McRaven had considered Brennan a trusted friend and critical partner in that unique mission. Earlier in 2018, McRaven and Brennan had been together in Austin at the University of Texas, where McRaven was finishing his work as university chancellor. They headlined a panel discussing the importance of leadership and praising each other's steady support in the years-long search for bin Laden's hideout and the tense assault on his compound. McRaven was enjoying his semi-retirement, visiting a friend in the Colorado Mountains when he heard the news that Trump was revoking Brennan's security clearance. The next day, August 16th, he had plans to go fly fishing in a beautiful river valley, but felt an urge, a duty even, to speak out in Brennan's defense. McRaven had spotty cell reception and no wireless connection, so sending an email was not an option. He asked his host if he could use the landline at his home. First, he gathered his thoughts and scribbled a few phrases on a piece of paper. Then he called the cell phone of a reporter he knew and trusted. As a child growing up in San Antonio, McRaven had been in the same fifth-grade class as Karen Tumulty, who had become a distinguished political correspondent at The Washington Post and had recently moved to the opinion section as a columnist. McRaven figured he would give her an on-the-record quote she could share with whichever Post colleague was writing about the Brennan controversy. Tumulty was heading to a doctor's appointment when the Admiral dialed. She didn't recognize the Colorado number and let the call go to voicemail. Not sure when he'd be able to call her back later, McRaven decided to speak aloud into the voicemail message, saying what he would tell Trump directly if he had the chance.
"Here is what I've come up with," he said. "Do whatever you want to with it, Karen."
Then he dictated his comment verbatim.
"Former CIA Director John Brennan, whose security clearance you revoked on Wednesday, is one of the finest public servants I have ever known. Few Americans have done more to protect this country than John. He is a man of unparalleled integrity, whose honesty and character have never been in question, except by those who don't know him. Therefore, I would consider it an honor if you would revoke my security clearance as well, so I can add my name to the list of men and women who have spoken up against your presidency. Like most Americans, I had hoped that when you became president, you would rise to the occasion and become the leader this great nation needs. A good leader tries to embody the best qualities of his or her organization. A good leader sets the example for others to follow. A good leader always puts the welfare of others before himself or herself. Your leadership, however, has shown little of these qualities. Through your actions, you have embarrassed us in the eyes of our children, humiliated us on the world stage, and worst of all, divided us as a nation. If you think for a moment that your McCarthy-era tactics will suppress the voices of criticism, you are sadly mistaken. The criticism will continue until you become the leader we prayed you would be." Waiting in the reception area to see her doctor, Tumulty played the mystery caller's voicemail. She was stunned by what she heard. She called McRaven back, but only talked briefly to him because he was finally heading out to fish. She told him she felt sure the Post would publish some of his reaction, and McRaven said he'd be out of pocket for a while, but trusted her to handle it. They hung up. As Tumulty sat in the waiting room transcribing McRaven's voicemail recording, she felt certain it deserved more than a few quotes in a news story. A national military hero had called the president a national embarrassment and a poor role model for America's children. He even compared Trump to Joseph McCarthy. She consulted with her editors, and they agreed they should publish McRaven's impromptu speech word for word as an opinion piece. McRaven's essay went viral. It drew notice deep in the bowels of the country's national security apparatus, where public servants working many rungs below McRaven had been silently disgusted watching Trump disrespect them and their brethren. They took private comfort reading McRaven's words. As one of those low-level cogs described it, "Finally, somebody revered, a bold-faced name, was declaring, in essence, no more." Before Trump, this government aide had always felt the presidency had a kind of magic. No matter which party the president came from, he bore the weight of history on his shoulders with the seriousness it deserved, but not anymore. "He's ruined that magic," this aide said of Trump. "The disdain he shows for our country's foundation and its principles, the disregard he has for right and wrong, your fist clenches. Your teeth grate. The hair goes up on the back of your neck. I have to remind myself, I said an oath to a document in the National Archives. I swore to the Constitution. I didn't swear an oath to this jackass." As this aide saw it, there has been a silent understanding within the national security community that diplomatic, military, and intelligence officers were doing the right thing, quietly risking their lives to protect the American way of life. This aide saw Trump's move against Brennan as one of the first steps of undercutting America's democratic system of government and the belief system upon which it was founded. According to the aide, it was the president declaring, "It's not okay to disagree with me. I can remove you from this work and your career." If he wanted to, how far could he push this? This aide asked. Look back. Did people in the 1930s in Germany know when the government started to turn on them? Most Americans are more worried about who is going to win on America's Got Talent and what the traffic is going to be like on I-95. They aren't watching this closely. I like to believe Trump is too self-engrossed, too incompetent and disorganized to get us to 1930, this aide added. But he has moved the bar, and another president that comes after him can move it a little farther. The time is coming. Our nation will be tested. Every nation is. Rome fell, remember. He is opening up vulnerabilities for this to happen. That is my fear. On August 21st, in a courtroom in Lower Manhattan, Michael Cohen was set to appear that afternoon as part of a plea agreement with federal prosecutors related to the hush money payments he made to women claiming to have had affairs with Trump. More than 250 miles south, in a federal courthouse in Alexandria, Virginia, a jury was deliberating on charges against Paul Manafort, the former Trump campaign chairman. Just after 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Cohen pleaded guilty to 8 felony counts and agreed to cooperate with prosecutors in New York. He testified that he had made these criminal payments in coordination and at the direction of Trump. At nearly the same time, the jury in Alexandria reached a verdict in the Manafort case. Manafort was also found guilty of, coincidentally, 8 counts. 5 counts of tax fraud, 2 counts of bank fraud, and 1 count of failure to disclose a foreign bank account. The judge declared a mistrial on the remaining 10 charges. The news broke as the president traveled to West Virginia for a rally, where he used his bully pulpit to repeatedly denounce the Mueller investigation as a witch hunt. The president cried out, his voice rising, "Where is the collusion? Where is the collusion?" Unbeknownst to his throngs of supporters or the journalists covering the day's events, Trump had used this day to try to win the Nobel Peace Prize. He worked the phones, seeking a recommendation for the prize. His main target was Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who had proven to be the most obsequious of his major nation counterparts, but he called other Asian heads of state, too. As Trump lobbied foreign counterparts, his pitch went along the lines of, "It's time. Obama got it without doing anything. I brought peace to North Korea. I need to win the Nobel." Winning a Nobel had been a fixation of Trump's, in large part because Obama was awarded one in 2009, less than 1 year into his presidency. Trump's hunger for recognition extended to other prizes, too. Oftentimes, when he heard about somebody receiving a lifetime achievement award from a think tank, for instance, Trump would complain to aides and argue that he deserved it more. At one point in late 2017, he even suggested that he might award himself the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which President Harry S. Truman established as the nation's highest civilian award. As Trump reviewed the biographies of potential candidates for the Presidential Medal of Freedom, he remarked to aides, "Well, I've probably done even more. Maybe I should be the one getting this." On August 27th, Trump wanted to turn a personal phone call with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto, celebrating a new U.S.-Mexico trade deal, into a live news conference. This was just another whim from the president, who called himself a game day player. Aides had to rush to satisfy him. With the press pool whisked into the Oval Office and gathered around the Resolute desk, Trump pushed the button on his phone to greet Peña Nieto. "Enrique?" Trump said. There was no response. Silence. The line was dead. Trump was impatient. "You can hook him up," he called out to aides. "You tell me when. This is a big deal. A lot of people are waiting." Trump tried again. "Hello," he said. "Do you want to put that on this phone, please? Hello?" Finally, an aide picked up the handheld receiver and patched Peña Nieto through to Trump. The two presidents carried on with the conversation. It turned out Peña Nieto had been properly connected on the other line. The problem was that Trump wasn't used to picking up the handset to ensure that the other side could hear him. John Kelly and Sanders had greenlighted Trump's idea to conduct his call with Peña Nieto live, with television cameras running, with only 20 minutes' notice. White House communications officials did not have time to do a pretest to make sure the phone lines would connect properly. "By 2 minutes to get it right," one top aide said later. "Mexico is not going to hang up the fucking phone. Nobody. Nobody is going to hang up on the President of the United States." Trump and his aides had debated whether to tell the Mexicans that Peña Nieto's voice would be played on speakerphone live on TV. Ultimately, they concluded that they had to. The White House would later tell reporters that they coordinated the call in advance with the Mexican government. That was taking major license with the word coordinated. The White House gave the Mexican president's office only about 120 seconds' notice of what Trump was planning to do. That lack of advance preparation was clear in Peña Nieto's halting language. To celebrate the deal, Peña Nieto offered a tequila toast. Trump loathed John McCain. Even as the Arizona senator was dying of brain cancer at his Sedona ranch, Trump attacked him at his rallies over his decisive 2017 vote against the GOP's proposed health care overhaul. After McCain passed away on August 25, 2018, at the age of 81, Trump stubbornly rejected his aide's suggestion to issue a statement about his death. The White House briefly flew the American flag at full staff, even though Washington protocol dictated that it remain at half-staff until the senator was laid to rest. On September 1st, McCain's memorial service at Washington National Cathedral served not only as a memorial for an American hero, but also as a stinging rebuke of Trump and Trumpism. The cathedral rang with paeans to bipartisanship, compromise, and civility, in a melancholy last hurrah for all that now seemed lost. One by one, mourners celebrated elements of McCain's epic life, basic decency and morality, common values that transcended ideology, class, or race, service to nation over self, that Trump most starkly lacked. Meghan McCain, the late senator's 33-year-old daughter, delivered the rawest repudiation. "We gather here to mourn the passing of American greatness, the real thing, not cheap rhetoric from men who will never come near the sacrifice he gave so willingly, nor the opportunistic appropriation of those who lived lives of comfort and privilege while he suffered and served." Gathered in the pews was a collection of global elites, the previous three presidents, and every major party nominee for the past two decades, military generals, intelligence chiefs, senators and representatives, foreign ambassadors, and other world leaders. The lone man out was Trump, who spent the day golfing at his Virginia course because the McCain family made clear he would not be welcome at the service. His isolation was underscored by the chumminess inside the cathedral, where Hillary Clinton sat shoulder to shoulder with Dick Cheney, and at one point George W. Bush snuck candies to Michelle Obama. Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner attended at the invitation of Senator Lindsey Graham, a close friend of McCain's, and rubbed elbows with the very people who so disdained the president. Kelly and Jim Mattis had special roles in the proceedings. The White House Chief of Staff and Defense Secretary escorted McCain's widow, Cindy, into the cathedral and were seated prominently in camera view. And as he watched clips of them on television, Trump grew furious, telling other advisors that he felt Kelly and Mattis had betrayed him by sidling up to the McCain family. On September 5th, Trump became irate when the New York Times published an extraordinary editorial. The title was, "I Am Part of the Resistance Inside the Trump Administration." And the author was anonymous, identified by the Times only as a senior official. The column was without precedent, and it was published a day after the first revelations surfaced from Bob Woodward's Fear, also a scalding portrait of the president. The anonymous editorial writer described Trump as impetuous and accused him of acting in a manner that is detrimental to the health of our republic. The official also alleged that there had been early whispers among members of Trump's cabinet about invoking the 25th Amendment to remove him from office, but that they decided to instead work within the government to contain him. It amounted to a portrait painted from within of what Senator Bob Corker had called the adult daycare center. Administration aides were so alarmed by the column and by the president's resulting fury, that some texted each other the phrase, "The sleeper cells have awoken." One recently departed White House official likened it to the opening sequence in When a Stranger Calls, a 1979 psychological thriller. "It's like the horror movies when everyone realizes the call is coming from inside the house." Trump considered figuring out the identity of Anonymous one of the government's most pressing priorities. Beginning just after dawn on September 6th, press statements forcefully denying that they were the author rolled in one by one from more than two dozen cabinet members and other top administration officials. They read as public declarations of absolute loyalty to Trump. On September 7th, Trump directed the Justice Department to investigate the author of the Resistance op-ed. He spoke freely to reporters that day about his fresh paranoia regarding whom in his midst he could trust. "What I do now is I look around the room," he said. "I say, hey, if I don't know somebody." White House staff began going through records to see who had outstanding copies of foreign leader calls with the president, as well as other sensitive documents. A White House official made a request to Mattis's assistant. Why hadn't the Defense Secretary's office returned some of the copies of readouts of the president's calls with foreign leaders? The White House needed them returned ASAP. This was a normal housecleaning request, but some officials at the Pentagon felt the timing conveyed an undeniable message. We're watching you. In early September 2018, Trump's lawyers finally reached a conclusion with Mueller over his request for a presidential interview. Trump's lawyers had argued to prosecutors all summer why they didn't believe it was necessary to provide the president's responses to their questions, and tried to appear open to a possible compromise for him to provide limited answers. The discussion took the form of a volley of emails and memos between Trump's lawyer Jane Raskin and her old law firm friend James Quarles. Some of the correspondence was rudimentary. The Trump lawyers wanted to know what criminal statutes Mueller's team was investigating as possible crimes, and why this would require answers from the president. Raskin's shorthand version was something to the effect of, "You have told us our client is the subject of the investigation, and you won't even tell us what you are looking at." It took roughly 3 weeks to get an answer to that question. Quarles responded that the statutes governed the criminal acts of hacking under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, as well as the very general crimes of wire fraud and mail fraud. Trump's lawyers shrugged. "That's it? That's useless," they said to each other. They were certain the president hadn't engaged in any of those crimes. Mueller's team would be silent for long stretches, especially later in the summer. At one point, Quarles told the Trump lawyers that it was important to ask about the president's view of events surrounding his pursuit of the Trump Tower Moscow project, as well as his role in describing Donald Trump Jr.'s 2016 meeting with a Russian lawyer who was expected to provide damaging information on Clinton. Raskin and her colleagues had a shared reaction. "What conceivably is criminal about that? Why do you want to ask about that?" The president's team also argued that prosecutors were not entitled to question Trump on decisions he made as president because anything prosecutors needed to know from Trump's time in office could be obtained from the thousands of documents and dozens of witnesses the White House had helped provide. In early August, Raskin summed up the team's views on this and made what the team considered their closing argument. The Mueller team had failed to make a compelling case for an interview. The line went dead. The Trump team got no response throughout the remainder of the month. The silence was mildly nerve-wracking. Trump's lawyers suspected these lulls were caused by a third party, the Department of Justice, specifically Rod Rosenstein, who was supervising Mueller's work. It felt to Trump's counselors that the special counsel's office was checking with the boss about how strenuously it could threaten the president or what it could claim before it did so. Trump's lawyers figured Rosenstein had been recommending an incremental approach. "It was like when Princess Diana said there are three people in this marriage," one Trump advisor recalled, a reference to the late Princess of Wales's infamous quip about her husband, Prince Charles, and his relationship with Camilla Parker Bowles. The Mueller folks felt they were fighting a battle on two sides, against us and against DOJ. My sense is DOJ was telling them to do certain things. Raskin and her husband, Martin, went on a long-scheduled vacation over Labor Day weekend to Flathead Lake, a breathtaking part of Montana just south of Glacier National Park. On the first full day of their trip, a family celebration, Jane Raskin was on the main drag in quiet Missoula when she got a call on her cell phone from Quarles. He was providing her with a heads-up that he was sending a new letter to the Trump team. The Raskins braced for bad news. But as they read the letter together the first week of September, they quickly realized everything had broken Trump's way. Mueller had effectively capitulated. The special counsel would accept written answers from the president, for now, on a limited set of questions. Trump's lawyers were ecstatic. The nuclear missile they had always feared Mueller was just a few keystrokes away from launching, a subpoena, would never come. "Everything was about the grand jury subpoena," a member of Trump's legal team said. "Until it became obvious there wasn't going to be one, we had won."